I think it's a mixed record. We can look around us today, and I think today's landscape is particularly dark when we see both situations of outright armed conflict, where there's been erosion of respect for international humanitarian law, where war crimes are occurring, where there's impunity for those acts. Or we also see situations short of that, where there are risk factors for atrocity crimes, where there may be systematic discrimination or persecution or worse, and we don't have the kind of early response and early action we might like to make a difference. That being said, we've also seen, despite obvious failures, cases where the international community has come together to try to prevent the escalation of violence, whether you think of Kenya in 2007 or Guinea in 2009, even what we see today in Burundi, an effort to act perhaps earlier when there have been instances of political violence, but when we're not in a situation of full-scale crisis, an attempt on the part of the international community to try to exert some pressure.
The crisis in Syria, it's been devastating in terms of human cost, and some critics of the responsibility to protect say that it is dead, that it hasn't been able to protect people because of Syria, because of maybe cases like Libya. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, I think it's a very powerful observation that we have seen massive protection failures. And as you say, the cost has been staggering. If we look at the lost development gains, if we look at the loss of life, and we look at the effect on communities and what their relations are likely to be over the next generation. I think it's difficult, however, to blame a principle for failure. A principle like responsibility to protect cannot compel states to do anything. It can only remind them of their responsibilities and provide them with guidance on the tools that they might use. But the responsibility to protect doesn't dictate a particular solution. That will be case by case. And certainly in the case of Syria, given the rapidity with which it descended into violence, it required concerted action on the part of the Security Council, which at crucial moments was simply not forthcoming. So I don't think the principle has been at all absent in that the responsibilities that states have, both in terms of the government of Syria itself, but also neighboring states who have helped to fuel this conflict by being, frankly, very irresponsible in either their provision of armaments or their political support for opposing sides. We have attempted, all of us in the UN system and elsewhere, to remind those actors of their responsibility, to indicate that this is a matter of international concern. And also we've seen some attempts as productive or unproductive as they may appear from the outside, there's been, you know, some very concerted actions taken. We've had powerful reports of commissions of inquiry. We've had neighboring states take hundreds of thousands of refugees. We've attempted to launch a mediation process. But it is a very difficult case, and I think people are right to question whether states are living up to their responsibilities.
Isn't your biggest challenge actually getting these countries to come together to agree on a common position? And if that's one of the main challenges, what's being done to remedy that?
At least in its what we call its third pillar, when we're talking about the international community's role in providing timely and decisive response, it is reliant on collective action. And sometimes that action can be mobilized, and sometimes it can't. And the reasons for that are varied. It may be different political interests. It may be a belief in a lack of capacity, a lack of leverage with parties on the ground, or a lack of capacity to coordinate those actions. A lot of times parties on the ground can divide the international community to their advantage. But in this sense, the responsibility to protect suffers from the same dilemma as other principles of its kind. Whether the principle existed or not, we would have collective action issues of this kind. It is one of the fundamental features of of our international system, that we don't have a world state, we don't have a world police force. We need to mobilize collective action. So understanding better how some of the obstacles to political action can be overcome, whether it's leadership that's required, whether it's particular institutional mechanisms, you know, whatever that might be, I think is really an imperative for all of us looking at the failures of the last few years.
And what's in store for the future of the principle?
I think post this 10 years, and we've had in this 10 years a lot of discussion at a conceptual level and fleshing out the framework for implementation, the next 10 years is about implementation at the national and regional and international level. And it's within national governments themselves that I think we need to now focus our attention, both to building early warning capacities and also the institutions and mechanisms to resist these dynamics, but also to provide the resources in a very targeted way to those international efforts that can make a difference to preventing this kind of systematic violence or, as a second best, addressing crises when they're at an early stage. And so the next 10 years is about very much that bottom-up micro-level progress. I think we've moved beyond debating this at a conceptual level. We have agreement that it's important and necessary, but now we need to move it into practice.